War and oil is the subject journalist Yusuf Ibrahim has been researching for a book he intends to write. Ibrahim has written extensively about oil and the Middle East. He's a former Middle East reporter for the New York Times. He wrote for a news publication geared to the oil industry, and he's a former senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He covered the first Gulf War and went back to the Gulf at the start of the war with Iraq. He was in Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, and the United Arab Emirates. A few days ago, he returned to the U.S. for a brief visit. He's now heading back to Iran. I spoke with Yusuf Ibrahim yesterday from New York. Do you think the fact that the United States invaded Iraq and overthrew Saddam Hussein is helping at all in moving things forward in the Middle East?
On one level, absolutely. I think there is general relief in the whole region, and nobody's feeling sorry at all for Saddam Hussein or his people. In the same time, I was a little taken aback, having spent 2 months in the region and having gone into Iraq, as a matter of fact, that there was a sentiment that the United States did it too easily. I hate to put it this way, but this is actually the feeling you get out there, that people wanted Saddam out, but they wanted the United States to get a black eye out of it. And the United States somehow didn't get a black eye. So the resentment was against both Saddam for having gotten us into this mess, that's what people would say, and the United States for using this to come in and occupy Iraq and then spread its hegemony over the region. Conflicting sentiments, it's a fluid time, a time where people are confused, they're still making up their mind, but to answer your question, ultimately, I would say a lot of people out there are so fed up with their own governments that in the end of the day, they look at this new paradigm, the invasion of Iraq, as perhaps the beginning of changes all over the place.
Which countries did you find that people felt this way?
I would say Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and certainly Saudi Arabia.
And you're talking about citizens of those countries, not the governments.
Yeah. I'm talking about a wide range of people, ranging from intellectuals to ordinary people to members of the ruling families themselves or the ruling establishment. When I say families, I'm speaking, of course, of Saudi Arabia. Ruling establishment includes the business communities, the elite, the academics. Most of these people who have suffered for a long time under the yoke of both tyrannical government and the Muslim fundamentalist sway over everything are hoping this is a chance to shake that formula.
So you think that the, quote, Arab street still resents the United States but is glad to see Saddam Hussein go. It doesn't wish the United States well particularly, but it thinks that things are improved in the region because Saddam Hussein is no longer there?
It's not Saddam Hussein himself, but it is the message that the doing away with Saddam Hussein and the fact that not a single Iraqi has lifted a finger to protect Saddam Hussein, that the Arab street is thrilled is. Why? Because it sends the message to their own governments that, see, when you are tyrannical, you lose all support. And when this happens to you, nobody's going to come up to defend you.
Right. Now, during the war and its aftermath, what was your focus? Where have you been? What kind of stories have you been looking for?
I was looking for the ripple effect, both financially, oil-wise, and politically, of this historical event, which is an American occupation of a major Arab country and of an Arab capital that, after all, is a pillar of Arab civilization. There is another thing I was looking for, and that's what is the oil repercussion of this. I mean, the United States has gone into Iraq with the neoconservative wing of the Bush administration saying it will revive the oil industry to American benefit and basically turn Iraq into an American private gasoline pumping station. And of course, these plans are not panning out and proving to be very difficult, which we all expected would be the case. And certainly, I was expecting and watching, and I'm still expecting and watching, when and how Iraqi resistance to the American occupation will manifest itself, not only in Iraq, but outside Iraq. And my fears about the way it manifests itself outside Iraq, I'm afraid, are coming true. I was in Saudi Arabia when the housing complexes were bombed. I arrived the day before. And I went to some of them, to one of them, Al Hamra, and watched the devastation. This was a massive attack. It so happens that about the same time, there was the attack in Casablanca, Morocco, which was also inspired probably by the same Al-Qaeda. And there was the attack in Chechnya, where now Chechen rebels are more and more attached to the same sort of Western coalition. In other words, the Al-Qaeda, as it has morphed into a club for everybody who hates the West and America, etc., etc. So I was watching for all of these things, and I'm still watching for all of these things.
Let's look at how the war has affected oil so far. Let's start with consumers. Has the war affected prices?
Not at all. In fact, it's the price has come down and it's stable. Even though there is not any oil coming out of Iraq at the moment, the moment is right because the war on Iraq came as we are entering the summer. And as you know, Terry, traditionally this is a period where consumption of oil diminishes anyway because you don't have any more heating, fuel, oil, all of that stuff. So, and furthermore, even before we entered the war, people were so freaked out and afraid that there was a $5 per barrel, what I call psychological premium added to the price of oil that was not justified. It was only justified by psychological reasons. But in fact, there was enough oil in the market. So once the operation went, quote-unquote, smoothly, people relaxed. And now the price of oil it is at a very reasonable level. We don't really need Iraqi oil. We can do without it until the onset of the winter. So we have a picnic until around November.
What kind of condition is the oil industry of Iraq in now?
Lamentable. I would say it is in horrible condition. To begin with, before the war, it was already running on band-aids. They were under sanctions. They couldn't import spare parts. They were cannibalizing everything they had to just keep the machine running. But in the process, of course, they were damaging the oil production infrastructure. So, and then of course, during the war, there was a lot of damage that was done. We have yet to estimate the damage that was done to oil facilities here and there. And of course, there was the political damage, which is the Kurds are sitting up there in the north, claiming the northern oil fields to themselves and, you know, trying to sequester this. And in the south, we have the Shiites and the Iranian-inspired forces also claiming those oil fields. And we have also severed the pipeline that used to pump oil from Iraq to Syria. Therefore, there is not only not much oil coming out of Iraq, there is not even enough oil being pumped to satisfy Iraqi needs. In other words, this is a country that has the second largest oil reserves in the world, which is in a position now where it has to import gasoline in order to, and people have to stand in line for 4 to 6 hours to fill their cars. It's extremely ironical that this should happen in the country that's a major, major oil producer.
The Bush administration wants Iraqi oil to pay for the reconstruction of Iraq. What are going to be the challenges in making that happen?
Well, it's simple arithmetic. Even if Iraq manages to return to its previous oil production level and passes this, suppose they manage to produce 3 million barrels a day, all you have to do is the mathematics. Multiply 3 million barrels every day by the price of oil, which averages at this point $24, $26. I can't do the mathematics right now, but roughly the entire income of Iraq is going to be in the ranging between $20 billion a year to $25 billion a year. That's nothing. There's no way you can rebuild Iraq with that kind of income per year. Iraq has war debts of $160 billion. And
this is dating back to the first Gulf War?
Dating back to the 1990-1991 reparations it has to pay. And even if we forgive those debts or postpone them, which is the case right now, the reconstruction of Iraq is estimated to cost between 100 to 150 billion. Remember, you got to repair the water system, the electricity system, the electricity grids, the infrastructures, the roads, the bridges. $20 billion a year with all these debts and the fact that you got to use them to feed the population leaves absolutely nothing to rebuild Iraq.
During your travels through the Gulf, did you meet with any oil company executives?
I did several times, yes. And there are very few of them, by the way, who are left. As you know, I was in Saudi Arabia, as I just told you, Terry, after the bombing of these complexes where foreigners live. Well, as you know, 7 Americans died in these bombings, and as many as 34 non-Americans died. I mean, Pakistanis, Egyptians. Why? Because the Americans had already left. As a matter of fact, this war and the run-up to this war and the aftermath of this war is actually driving American business, including American oil executives, out of the region. In America, as you know, with all the human resources, rights, and laws that we have, an American company would take a very serious risk if it exposes employees to death or injury. And therefore, we have asked most of our expatriates to leave. There are very few all the American schools, for example, in all Muslim countries have shut down. In Jakarta, Indonesia, the American schools have been shut down for 7 months, which means that the women and children, dependents of American oil executives, have had to leave, have gone back home. And you have a lot of stressed men, because most of these guys in the oil business are men, who are living alone, and who are living alone and having to check their car for planted bombs every morning for a half an hour before they ride into them. There's a lot of tension, there's a lot of foul moods, and there are fewer and fewer expatriates who are remaining in the region.
What's happening with the contracts, the oil contracts that Iraq had with France and with Russia?
That's an interesting question indeed, not only for you and I, but for the lawyers. The Russians are the only ones who actually signed physical contracts with Iraq. The French spoke with the Iraqis for 10 years about many, many projects which are on the table. And of course, they would feel extremely hostile if they were excluded. But the Russians have actually gone so far as to say that they have legally binding contracts with the government of Iraq, regardless of who is in the government of Iraq, and that they would take legal action. They would even take physical action. They said they would seize on the high sea any tankers loaded with Iraqi oil unless this issue is resolved. In other words, the Russians are being extremely hard-nosed. They say we have deals. We insist that these deals must be dealt with. Now, I suspect much of this has been discussed quietly between President Bush and President Putin. I don't think the president President Bush has spoken much to Jacques Chirac, but the French are quite determined also to have their quote-unquote share of the pie. So the legal status of these contracts depends on two things that are not resolved yet. First, you must have a legitimate Iraqi government in place for anybody to sign a contract with it. We do not have this. We have an occupation force, which is the United States, and it, according to the Geneva Conventions and international law, an occupation force cannot sign contracts dealing with the Iraqi oil, which does not belong to it, with anybody. And secondly, we have all these contracts outstanding out there, which must be resolved in an international forum, legal forum of some sort.
So the answer to the question I asked, what's up with the contracts that Iraq had, the oil contracts Iraq had with France and Russia, the answer to that question might come years from now?
It's in limbo, and it depends a lot on political goodwill and the fact that in the end of the day, we have to reach a stable situation in Iraq. We are not there yet. First, the United States has to control Iraq. Secondly, it has to install an Iraqi government that is widely viewed, and by widely I mean within Iraq and outside Iraq, as a legitimate government of some sort. And then, after this, this government, perhaps with the help of the United States, can sit down with all these companies and countries and start inviting bids for people to come in. And you got to remember, Terry, something that's very important. The limbo is also financial. If you are the CEO of Exxon or of Chevron or of Total, the French oil company, you have obligations to your shareholders. Now, how are you going to explain to your shareholders that you're about to go and plunk $1 billion or $2 billion of their money, of the company's money, in a country when you are not absolutely sure that in 2 or 3 years it will have a government that will honor any contract it has signed with you? So I suspect at the moment the United States government, and I know that, no, I don't suspect, I know that for a fact, has had a lot of trouble convincing American oil companies to go and invest in Iraq. Instead, what we are doing is the United States government is paying American service companies to go and do a job in Iraq fixing the system.
Yeah, which leads me to wonder, what reactions did you see to the Bechtel and Halliburton contracts in Iraq?
You know, the usual skepticism, like, didn't we tell you? We told you so. The Americans are going to take it all, that kind of thing. But let's be fair. On the other hand, the Iraqi people are in a desperate condition. And there is also a fair amount of goodwill. I mean, if you're coming to help me to fix my system, I would like to help you for two reasons. First, if you hire me, I need the money. So it's very important that we hire Iraqis to do these jobs, not bring in American engineers and so on and so forth to do it for them, or American technicians. It's also very important that we be extremely sensitive to national pride and the national sentiment on the ground. In other words, you don't want an American oil engineer ordering an Iraqi oil engineer who just feels he is just as good as him or her or better in a way that is perceived as a slight to their national pride. But in the end of the day, Iraqis would like to see their country repaired and put back together. And to the degree that they see that this is done for the purpose of rebuilding Iraq, not of staying in Iraq forever and making Iraq one a client state of the United States, they will cooperate.
The United States has accused Iran of developing nuclear weapons, and some people believe that Iran might be next, that we might actually, you know, that we're sending out threats to Iran now, or perhaps subtle threats, but, you know, that we might possibly attack Iran next. What is your reading of that situation?
Well, certainly Iran is beginning to wonder about the same thing. When I was there, instead of getting answers, I was being asked a lot of questions from senior officials. I met three senior officials in Iran, and all three were a little puzzled. But to summarize their attitude, I would say it's, are they really crazy enough to think they're going to attack us?
How do you think, just like hypothetically, say the United States did attack Iran because of the threat of nuclear weapons, how might an attack of Iran compare to what happened in Iraq?
I think it will not compare at all. I think it will be different, and it will be much more costly. And I know a lot of people out there who say, people were saying this about Iraq and it didn't happen. The degree of discontent with the regime within Iran does not in any way resemble the degree of discontent that existed in Iraq. The reason people abandoned Saddam Hussein and his clique is that they were a bunch of complete bloody murderers. I mean, we are discovering all these mass graves now. We are discovering the tortures, the perhaps thousands of people who were executed. And now, Iran is not like that. And furthermore, Iran already had its revolution 30 years ago. And it is within if you look at it from a certain perspective, it does have a much wider margin of democratic debate, of give and take, albeit controlled by the clergy. But there is very liberal clergy, like President Khatami, and very conservative clergy. They don't like the United States. They have tried to resume a dialogue with the United States, and they really sent several signals. You remember when we attacked Afghanistan, they made it very clear by sending a signal saying, if any American pilots were to fall, we will help with the rescue of those American pilots. We never even responded to that, except eventually the president came on and gave his famous axis of evil speech, and that all dialogue with Iran stopped. I think the Iranian position now is two things. They're putting two cards on the table with the United States. One card says, look, we are happy you got rid of Saddam Hussein. We are a regional power here. It is time you show us some respect. Let us let bygone be bygone, and let's start talking about a relationship. First, you lift the sanctions, and we promise not to make trouble in the region. Then they're putting another card on the table saying, you are now in our neighborhood. You are right close to us. You have 160,000 American troops who really are stranded in Iraq, in a way checkmated in Iraq. They don't know when they're going to get out. They don't know if they're going to get out, and they're facing resistance. We can make life tougher for you. So choose, which do you want? Right now, we are occupying a country of 24 million people, and we are having some trouble, quote-unquote, digesting Iraq. Can you imagine if we go on and occupy a country next door of 65 million people? Do you think we can digest these two countries? I doubt that very much. I think we'll find ourselves in the big Q word would have to come in here, quagmire.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you safe travels on your return to the Gulf. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Youssef Ibrahim, he's reported from the Middle East for the New York Times, and he's a former senior fellow at the Council for Foreign Relations. He's researching a book on war and oil. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Amy Sallet, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.